We handle the process from start to finish, and your donation may qualify for a significant tax deduction. Turn your property into something meaningful. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more.
You're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
It is Thursday, November 13th. I'm Scott Baba. Starbucks workers go on strike across the country. Israeli settler violence continues in the West Bank. After 43 days, the federal government begins reopening, and Congress inches closer to releasing the Epstein files. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. More than 1,000 unionized Starbucks workers walked off the job at 65 U.S. stores today to protest stalled contract negotiations with the coffee giant. The strike coincided with Starbucks' annual Red Cup Day, one of its busiest sales events when customers receive free usable cups with holiday drinks. Michelle Eisen has been a Starbucks barista for 15 years and is a spokesperson for Starbucks Workers United. She said that striking Starbucks workers are making three very clear demands.
Striking baristas are making three very clear demands: more take-home pay, better hours and staffing, and fair treatment under the law. That means an end to the union busting and the resolution of the hundreds of unfair labor practice charges that Starbucks has piled up. Starbucks' failure to meet these demands are exactly why we're turning Red Cup Day into Red Cup Rebellion. And it's just the beginning. If Starbucks continues to stonewall union baristas, we are prepared to make this the largest, longest strike in company history during the critical holiday season.
In a statement, Starbucks said most of its 10,000 company-owned stores remained open and that it was on pace to meet sales goals for the day. The company said it offers, quote, the best wage and benefit package in retail while maintaining its ready to negotiate. But striking barista Dachi Speltori said many workers don't make a living wage or can't get assigned enough hours to even qualify for the company's health care package. Meanwhile, she said the priorities of Starbucks management appears to be badly misplaced.
CEO Brian Nichol made $96 million. For 4 months of work last year. And the company spent $81 million on a glitzy conference just for managers in Las Vegas this summer. The math just isn't adding up. Starbucks has spent millions and millions on its executives and managers, but they're refusing to finalize a fair contract that would take less than either of those expenses. That's wild. Like, I want Starbucks to succeed. My livelihood depends on it. I know Starbucks' success has to include and prioritize the people who make the coffee, open the stores, and keep the customers coming back.
Starbucks Workers United said the walkout had already forced some store closures and could spread if the company doesn't return to the bargaining table. Around 550 Starbucks locations nationwide have unionized since 2021. California Attorney General Rob Bonta joined 18 other state attorney generals in opposing the Trump administration's expansion of expedited removal, a fast-track deportation process they say bypasses judges and basic legal safeguards. In an amicus brief filed in a case against Department of Homeland Security Chief Kristi Noem, the coalition urged the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit to uphold a lower court's temporary halt on the policy, which would allow federal officials to deport undocumented immigrants from anywhere in the U.S. without a hearing or access to legal counsel. Originally, expedited removal applied only to those apprehended at ports of entry or within 100 miles of a land border and within 14 days of entry. During Trump's first term, the rule was expanded to remove both its geographic and time limits, targeting anyone in the U.S. for less than 2 years who lacked proper entry documents or who entered by fraud, greatly increasing the risk of detention and deportation. That change was put on hold by the Biden administration, but earlier this year, Trump's DHS issued a new notice rescinding the prior rollback. Bonta said the policy threatens due process and could uproot families, harm communities, and endanger U.S.-born children in mixed-status households. He also warned of economic fallout, including job losses, lower GDP, and reduced tax revenue. Financial incentives appear to be spurring local law enforcement across the country to increase arrests of undocumented immigrants. According to the Department of Homeland Security, as of September of this year, over 1,000 local law enforcement agencies in at least 40 states have inked agreements with ICE that offer full reimbursements for the salaries and benefits of ICE-trained officers and quarterly performance-based bonuses of up to $1,000 per officer, depending on results in locating and arresting undocumented immigrants. Nadia Ramlagan has more.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested nearly 1,300 people in Kentucky in the first half of this year, a nearly 40% increase compared to last year. Experts say financial incentives are driving some local law enforcement to increase arrests. Local law enforcement agencies have entered into contracts with the Department of Homeland Security, known as 287G agreements, and in some cases are working to meet quotas, explains Ashley Spaulding with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy.
The efforts to arrest people are becoming more aggressive. So we're going to see more Kentuckians be arrested for immigration reasons.
Earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security rescinded rules that prevented ICE from arresting non-citizens in places like churches, schools, and hospitals. Experts say that move increased arrest of people who have no criminal history. According to the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, more than 70% of detained immigrants nationwide had no criminal conviction. This is Nadia Ramlagan.
Seven detainees at a privately run immigration detention center in California City, east of Bakersfield, have sued U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, alleging squalid conditions and dangerous lapses in medical care. The lawsuit filed yesterday in federal court in Northern California claims the facility is plagued by sewage leaks and insect infestations, and that detainees are denied adequate food, water, clothing, and access to their attorneys. It also alleges people with mobility issues lack wheelchairs and, in some cases, cannot bathe or dress themselves. The plaintiffs seek class action status on behalf of all detainees at California City Immigration Processing Center, which opened in August and now houses about 800 people. The center is operated by CoreCivic, which previously said it provides, quote, robust medical care. ICE declined to comment. The suit says the facility's rapid opening under the Trump administration's expanded deportation plan created a system with, quote, no meaningful accountability or oversight. First Lady Melania Trump is leading a new effort to expand career and education opportunities for children in foster care. President Donald Trump signed an executive order today creating the Fostering the Future program, which brings together federal agencies, nonprofits, schools, and private companies. The initiative includes an online hub to connect foster youth with resources, vouchers, and grants.
As we make America great again, we are going to protect American children in foster care, and we're going to ensure that they will never, ever be forgotten. These children will never be forgotten, and they're going to grow up to be unbelievable, strong, smart, wealthy, productive citizens.
Speaking in the East Room, Melania Trump called the effort, quote, empathetic and strategic, and urged organizations to join.
I predict this small spark today will ignite a profound and lasting nationwide movement. Our united resolve will foster a thriving future filled with compassion and innovation. Together, we will illuminate the pathway for today's foster children to become tomorrow's builders. And tomorrow's builders will foster the future of America's legacy.
The program builds on her Be Best campaign, which began offering scholarships to foster youth in 2021. A U.S. proposal to give the United Nations a mandate for an international stabilization force in Gaza faces opposition from Russia, China, and some Arab countries, this according to diplomats today. The plan, part of President Donald Trump's ceasefire framework, calls for a board of peace to temporarily govern Gaza, while a multinational force works to demilitarize the territory and secure aid deliveries. Russia and China have demanded the board be removed, and other Security Council members want more clarity on its role. The draft resolution also envisions a potential pathway to Palestinian self-determination once governance reforms and redevelopment advances, but the language is not binding. The U.S. urged the council to act quickly to maintain momentum, warning delays could harm Palestinians in Gaza. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. is seeking agreements on the resolution, quote, very soon. Diplomats said the U.S. could amend the draft, push it to a vote, or form a coalition of the willing outside the U.N. if consensus fails. Meanwhile, Israel said today that Hamas had returned the body of Meni Godard, one of the last four hostages taken in the October 7, 2023 attack that ignited the war in Gaza. Godard was a former professional soccer player and a veteran of the 1973 Mideast War. Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad have said his body was recovered in southern Gaza. Israel says 25 sets of remains have been returned since the ceasefire began on October 10th, with three hostages still unaccounted for. Under the agreement, Israel has exchanged 15 Palestinian bodies for each hostage, and Gaza health officials say they have received 315 sets of remains. Israel and Hamas have accused each other of violating parts of the deal, even as exchanges continue. The ceasefire is intended to lead to broader steps, including Trump's proposed stabilization force and the formation of a technocratic Palestinian government. A day after Israeli President Isaac Herzog and military chief Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir denounced attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in the West Bank, settlers torched and vandalized a mosque in the central West Bank overnight. Blake Sifton reports.
Israeli settlers reportedly set fire to a mosque in the northern West Bank on Thursday morning and sprayed racist graffiti on its walls. No injuries were reported in the latest in an increasing string of near-daily attacks targeting Palestinians and their property. The UN recorded 264 settler attacks in the West Bank that caused injuries, property damage, or both in October. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said,
"There's some concern about events in the West Bank spilling over and creating an effect that could undermine what we're doing in Gaza. We don't expect it to. We'll do everything we can to make sure it doesn't happen."
Blake Sifton, Tel Aviv.
Settler attacks have intensified in recent weeks in the West Bank as Palestinians harvest their olive trees in an annual ritual. And last month was the highest ever recorded number of settler attacks in the West Bank since the UN's humanitarian office began keeping track in 2006. Syria's foreign minister has reopened the country's embassy in London after more than a decade. Today's move marks another step in Syria's reintegration into the international community following the ouster of former President Bashar Assad. The visit to the United Kingdom by Foreign Minister Assad al-Shabani follows a historic visit to Washington by interim Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa. Al-Shabani described his meeting with UK Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper as successful. He noted Britain's early removal of sanctions and support in the UN Security Council, but recent sectarian violence in Syria has raised concerns about minority safety. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says pressure is being applied to countries supplying paramilitary forces in Sudan. He also decried the humanitarian situation and said, quote, something needs to be done to cut off the weapons and other supports that the paramilitary rapid support forces is receiving as it battles the Sudanese army. Rubio said yesterday that the U.S. knows who's involved in supplying the RSF and it must end. U.S. intelligence assessments for many months have found the United Arab Emirates, a close U.S. ally, has been sending weapons to the RSF. The UAE denies backing the RSF. It's to be a topic of discussion when Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman meets President Trump at the White House next Tuesday, according to a report from the Middle East Eye. Saudi Arabia is allied with Sudan's government, not the RSF. Also, the two will discuss a security pact. Earlier this year, a judge allowed a lawsuit to proceed against Saudi Arabia by victims of families killed in the 9/11 terrorist attack. The vast majority of attackers were Saudis, the financing coming from groups in that country. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said that the United States boycott of the G20 summit in South Africa later this month would not prevent the meeting of the world's leading economies from going ahead. Isaac Lukondo reports.
President Cyril Ramaphosa told reporters in the coastal city of Cape Town that fundamental decisions will be taken during the summit and that the absence of the Americans was their loss. Tensions have been rising between Pretoria and Washington ahead of the G20 summit set for November the 22nd to the 23rd, the first to be held on African soil. The clash over South Africa's summit agenda has prompted President Donald Trump to announce that no U.S. official will attend the Johannesburg gathering. Isaac Lukando, Dar es Salaam.
The United Nations COP30 Climate Summit entered its fourth day in Brazil with a focus on health. UN agencies and nations launched a health action plan, as well as other initiatives on refugees and food waste. Notably absent from the summit is the United States. The absence of the Trump administration drew criticism from participants and from House Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi. Christopher Martinez reports.
Day 4 of the UN Climate Summit, COP30, was Health Day, a time to look at the deep connections between human health and the health of the planet, as well as our responsibility to care for both. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, spoke to the link between the two issues at the start of the summit, saying a sick planet means sick people.
Here in the heart of the Amazon, the lungs of the earth, we're reminded that healthy people depend on a healthy planet. If our planet were a patient, it would be admitted to intensive care. Its vital signs are alarming.
He says health is the strongest argument for climate action. According to the World Meteorological Organization, extreme heat claims more than 500,000 lives each year. At the climate summit in Belém, Brazil, UN agencies and partners have launched a blueprint for global health systems to adapt to rising temperatures and extreme weather. The Belém Health Action Plan sets out steps to integrate health into climate strategies, including strengthening health systems to withstand climate shocks, mobilizing finance and technology, and ensuring communities have a voice. The adoption of the plan on Health Day marks a recognition that the climate crisis is also a health crisis. And for its part, the UN Refugee Agency joined in the effort, launching the Refugee Environmental Protection Fund, the world's first large-scale refugee-driven carbon finance initiative. The goal is to support reforestation, cleaner cooking, and green jobs. And the UN Environment Program launched an initiative to cut food waste in half by the year 2030, which would also reduce methane emissions linked to global warming. On day 4 of the summit, climate experts discussed findings that the world is falling short in its goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Anna Missilieu is with the New Climate Institute.
We also have countries that are backing away entirely from the UNFCCC process and backing ambition entirely. And as you might suspect, I'm talking about the U.S. here. The U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement has had really devastating effects. It weakened the global momentum.
The ongoing climate summit has drawn thousands of national leaders, diplomats, scientists, and others with delegations from around the world. but not from the United States. That's been a disappointment to many activists, but it has not stopped Americans from attending, with a large delegation of governors, mayors, and other elected officials going to the meeting. San Francisco Congressmember Nancy Pelosi blasted President Trump's decision to sit out the summit.
He pronounced that during Congress week that this was a con job. This is a scam. No, Mr. President, you are projecting again. You are the con job. You are the scam. You do not believe in science or responsibility or anything, and it's all about money in the pocket of your friends and billionaires, as we have seen even with health care.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Meanwhile, world climate leaders are now acknowledging that global temperatures are likely to exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit set in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, entering what scientists consider a danger zone. But officials stress the overshoot does not mean defeat. The 1.5 degree goal, measured against pre-industrial temperatures, is designed to limit the risks of extreme heat, coral reef collapse, ice sheet loss in Greenland and Antarctica, and potential disruptions to major ocean currents. Global temperatures are currently about 1.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and surpassed 1.5 degrees briefly last year. Experts say overshoot could last years or decades, but temperatures can eventually be brought back below the threshold through emissions cuts, natural carbon sinks like forests and oceans, and emerging technologies that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. United Nations officials and climate scientists stress that limiting warming remains critical to reduce the most catastrophic risks of climate change. The parents of two babies who were sickened in an infantile botulism outbreak linked to recalled ByHeart infant formula are suing the company. Lawyers for Stephen and Yurani Dexter of Flagstaff, Arizona, and Michael and Hannah Everett of Richmond, Kentucky, filed lawsuits yesterday in federal court in two states. The families allege that their four-month-old daughters, Rose Dexter and Piper Everett, developed the rare and potentially deadly disease after drinking recalled ByHeart formula. The babies are among 15 infants in a dozen states who have contracted infantile botulism during the outbreak that began in August. New York-based ByHeart recalled all of its formula nationwide on Tuesday. British political commentator Sami Hamdi said today that he is considering suing U.S. authorities over what he called his wrongful detention for criticizing Israel's actions in Gaza. Returning to the U.K. after leaving the U.S. voluntarily, Hamid said federal judges had exonerated him following what he described as a botched effort by extremists in the U.S. government to silence him. Hamdi said to reporters near Heathrow Airport, quote, "This wasn't just an attack on me. It was an attack on the freedom of ordinary Americans and citizens worldwide." Hamdi was detained by U.S. immigration agents on October 26, a day after speaking at a Council on American Islamic Relations gala in California. The Department of Homeland Security said his visa had been revoked and accused him of supporting Hamas-led attacks on Israel. Hamdi denied the allegations, saying his comments were misinterpreted. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history officially ended today, but the path to restoring normal operations across federal agencies, programs, and services will take days, and in some cases, weeks or even months. The 43-day closure disrupted the lives of millions of Americans, affecting federal workers, recipients of social programs, travelers, and cultural institutions. About 1.25 million federal employees who were either furloughed or worked without pay since October 1st were expected to return to work today. Back pay totaling roughly $16 billion is set to be distributed in four tranches by November 19th. The economic strain on households of federal workers has been substantial, with many struggling to cover rent, bills, and other expenses during the shutdown. Military families face disrupted move reimbursements, canceled weekend drills for reservists, and delayed pay, though active duty members largely continued receiving wages. The aviation system remains affected. Airlines were forced to cut flights in recent weeks due to unpaid air traffic controller shortages, And the FAA said limits remain until staffing and safety metrics improve. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said controllers would receive 70% of their back pay within 24 to 48 hours. Federal social programs are slowly recovering. Supplemental nutrition assistance program benefits, delayed for millions of lower-income households, are expected to be restored within a week in most states. Head Start centers said faced funding delays that disrupted child care and early education for thousands of children. Low-income home energy assistance program payments, critical as winter approaches, may not reach recipients until mid-December in some states. The Internal Revenue Service reopened walk-in centers, though a backlog of correspondence and delayed services remains. Education Department grants and impact aid payments for districts with federal land are also catching up after furloughs and temporary layoffs. National parks largely stayed open during the shutdown with limited staffing, but visitors encountered some closures, as well as vandalism at some sites, including at Arches National Park in Utah and Gettysburg National Military Park in Pennsylvania. Officials caution that full recovery will be incremental, with programs, grants, and services resuming over the coming weeks. A House Republican is urging Senate leaders to work across party lines to extend pandemic-era health care subsidies set to expire at year's end after Democratic demands during the government shutdown. The GOP refused to include such a provision in the funding bill that Trump signed into law last night after eight Democrats caved and joined Republicans in passing it. Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania sent the letter to Republican leader John Thune and Democratic leader Chuck Schumer today, noting he's co-chair of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. This comes as Democrats are vowing to continue the fight to extend the subsidies for some 22 million Americans who use it to pay for health insurance. Here's Democratic Minority Leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries.
We believe that working-class Americans, middle-class Americans, and everyday Americans deserve the same level of certainty that Republicans always provide to the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected. The same level of certainty.
A New York Times analysis of the estimates from the Kaiser Family Foundation said monthly premiums increase from $460 to $1,380 should the tax credits be allowed to expire. The House is moving towards a vote on releasing files from the sex trafficking investigation into Jeffrey Epstein. Republican leaders have no choice but to allow a vote after a petition on the Epstein bill reached the needed 218 signatures. Simone Perez reports.
After a long delay, the House swore in Arizona Democratic Representative Adelita Grijalva. One of her first official acts was to become the last needed signature on a discharge petition to force a vote on releasing the long-sought-after Epstein files. Trump is railing against the petition, but Speaker Mike Johnson says a move to release at least some Epstein files will get a vote next week. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt denies the importance of damning accusations from the files of late millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
This is another distraction campaign by the Democrat and the liberal media, and it's why I'm being asked questions about Epstein instead of the government reopening because of Republicans and President Trump.
One old Epstein email newly released by congressional Democrats on House oversight says President Donald Trump spent hours at Epstein's house with an underage girl. A separate one quotes Epstein as saying Trump obviously knew about the girls being sex trafficked. Leavitt says the email show Trump did nothing wrong. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The Justice Department sued today to block new congressional districts approved by California voters, escalating a high-stakes legal battle that could influence which party controls the U.S. House in 2026. The lawsuit challenges Proposition 50, a measure championed by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom that redraws districts to give Democrats a chance to flip five Republican-held seats. Federal officials argue the plan violates the Constitution by using race to favor Hispanic voters. They said, quote, race cannot be used as a proxy to advance political interests, but that is precisely what the California General Assembly did with Proposition 60 in the lawsuit. Attorney General Pam Bondi called the plan, quote, a brazen power grab that tramples on civil rights and mocks the democratic process. She added that Newsom's attempt to entrench one-party rule and silence millions of Californians will not stand. Proposition 50 was Newsom's response to a similar redistricting push in Texas, where Republicans, backed by President Donald Trump, redrew their congressional map earlier this year to boost GOP chances of gaining five House seats. That move triggered a wave of mid-decade map-making nationwide as states sought to lock in partisan advantages before the 2026 midterm elections. Newsom and Democratic allies argued that California's map was a necessary countermeasure to Republican gerrymandering elsewhere, while critics said it undermined the state's independent redistricting system. Voters approved the measure overwhelmingly last week. Newsom spokesperson Brandon Richards said opponents, quote, lost at the ballot box and soon they will lose in court. The Justice Department joined a lawsuit filed by the California Republican Party seeking to block use of the map in future elections. With Republicans holding a narrow 219 to 214 majority in the House, the outcome of the California case could have sweeping national implications, potentially determining which party holds power in Congress after next year's midterms. We'll be back with more news after this quick break.
And you are listening to the Pacifica News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online at kpfk.org.
Congressman Jared Huffman discussed the newly released emails about Donald Trump's alleged knowledge of Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking ring, changes to his newly reshaped district by Prop 50, and yesterday's House vote to reopen the government.
It was a discouraging day in many respects, Lauren. I mean, I'm glad the government is reopened, at least temporarily, most of it. But I think because a few Senate Democrats peeled off and cut a deal that I think is a pretty lousy deal. They didn't get really anything. We lost some leverage in this healthcare debate that we have, I think, been doing a very good job of putting into the national conversation. And so we're not going to stop fighting for the ACA subsidies and other parts of the healthcare crisis that have to be addressed. But I think a moment of leverage may have been lost because of what these Senate Democrats did.
The stopgap funding bill keeps most agencies running through the end of January. But again, it leaves out the ACA tax credits. With the Senate promising a separate vote by mid-December, how will those Democrats be able to hold Republicans accountable to that vote and that discussion?
Well, that's going to be up to these Senate Democrats who think they got a meaningful promise from these guys. I think they got very little, and I'll be shocked if that vote, you know, advances a bill over to the House. But if they can pull that off, and I'm rooting for them, we will still have to fight to get Mike Johnson to give it a vote in the House because he has been, you know, very, very cagey about that. And so it's just one of several reasons why I think it was a lousy deal that they cut. The other thing, Lauren, you may have heard, there's this very corrupt, outrageous midnight rider they put in there to make eight Republican senators overnight millionaires because a grand jury looked through their phone records.
And that's related to January 6th. Can you speak a little more about that provision?
Yeah, so look, there was a grand jury that was convened to look at a whole bunch of crimes relating to January 6th. In the course of that confidential grand jury proceeding, they issued subpoenas for the phone records of eight Republican senators, not wiretaps, but just to see who they were calling in those critical days, because some of these guys were up to their neck in the fake elector scam, and Lindsey Graham was shaking down state election officials. So, you know, to me, it's pretty valid that a grand jury would want to look into that. But, you know, these guys are, you know, treating it like it's a political Pearl Harbor, like it's just outrageous, and they want the taxpayers to give them each $1 million. And that's what they put into that bill. That each of them would automatically get $500,000 for the subpoena that the grand jury issued and another $500,000 for the judge's protective order, making it all confidential so that they wouldn't know in real time. And it's just sort of this situation, Lauren. Well, you know, most of us are old enough to remember that if a senator snuck a rider into a bill at any other time in our history, to put money in the pocket of like a donor or a company in their district, it would be a scandal, maybe even a career-ending scandal. But things are so bad right now that they're just putting the money right into their own pocket.
Even with that provision, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer stated that this is a victory for Democrats, saying that Republicans will now have to own the problem of rising health insurance premiums. Do you agree with Schumer's assessment?
No, not entirely. Look, the victory for Democrats is that House Democrats stayed very unified, and that the overwhelming number of House and Senate Democrats did a great job fighting for health care. And we elevated the issue and we created a lot of political pressure. That I think we can feel very good about. But the way these eight Democrats caved, no, I'm not happy with that. I'm not interested in spinning it into some happy talk.
And speaking of political pressure, there has been a seemingly explosive new development with additional emails being released by the House Oversight Committee, Adelita Grijalva being sworn in, which is given the bipartisan Epstein Files Transparency Act enough signatures. Can you talk about these developments, how members of Congress are reacting, and what the implications are for the country?
Yeah. Look, this is the scandal that Donald Trump cannot make go away. And it may be that the limits of his Teflon have been reached, because I think everyone who knows anything about this cover-up just has to believe. I mean, all of the evidence points to Donald Trump having some level of culpability and guilt in this sex trafficking scheme. Now, we don't know how deep into it he was, like with any of the victims, but all indications are that he knew or should have known about this in a big way. It seems rather obvious. And if you have nothing to hide, you don't do the stuff Donald Trump is doing to try to cover this up.
Is this something that Donald Trump could just dismiss as fake news or a, quote, Democratic hoax? Or could this really be the scandal that gets the bipartisan support for a future impeachment?
I don't know about impeachment, but I think the main thing is let's get bipartisan support for transparency for now. And we seem to have that. So I'm pleased. I think that really speaks to how powerfully this story resonates across political lines. I mean, this was just such a tragic scandal, and so deplorable in every way, and the fact that so many powerful people were in the thick of it. This is something, finally we found something, right, that an awful lot of Democrats and Republicans in our polarized country can agree on. Let's get to the bottom of this and let there be justice for whoever is involved.
And finally, Congressman Huffman, there's so much happening, but I'd be remiss not to mention that Proposition 50 just passed. And in closing, I'm hoping you can touch on what this means for District 2 and how you're planning on bringing representation to some of these areas that have historically had conservative leadership.
Yeah, thanks, Lawrence. So, look, I think it was a great election night. And yet I also know that I am taking on some deep red areas of the state that voted against Prop 50, that you know, have voted with Donald Trump. And so I'm going to have to introduce myself to them and try to identify some things I can do to make life better in those parts of the state. That's what I'm going to begin to do. The conversations have begun, but, you know, when you do this, you got to approach it with a degree of humility. I am not going to just parachute into these areas and act like I already know everything or know what's best for them. I'm going to try to do some listening, but I'm eager to get started, and those conversations have begun.
Thank you again, Congressman Jared Huffman.
No, thanks, Lauren.
Lawyers for two of President Donald Trump's foes have been charged by the Justice Department, have asked a federal judge to dismiss the cases against them, saying the prosecutor who secured the indictments was illegally installed. U.S. District Judge Cameron McGowan Curie didn't immediately rule on from the bench Thursday in the challenges to Lindsey Halligan's appointment as interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia. The requests are part of efforts by former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James to get their cases dismissed before trial. Comey has pleaded not guilty to charges of making a false statement and obstructing Congress. James has pleaded not guilty to mortgage fraud allegations. ProPublica has found several Trump administration officials have engaged in the same mortgage practices as James. Meanwhile, the abrupt ouster of several top Fannie Mae officials and internal ethics watchdogs last month has rattled the housing industry after they raised concerns that a confidant of Bill Pulte, President Donald Trump's housing regulator, improperly shared confidential mortgage pricing data with competitor Freddie Mac. Emails reviewed by the Associated Press show the officials had warned that Fannie Mae marketing chief Lauren Smith, acting at Pulte's direction, disclosed, quote, very problematic competitive information. Senior mortgage executive Malloy Evans alerted CEO Priscilla Almodovar and top attorneys, noting the data, quote, should never be shared. While Smith remains in her post, the officials who questioned her conduct were forced out, drawing condemnation from Democrats. Senator Elizabeth Warren said the shakeup shows Pulte using his influence to advance political aims. Pulte, a major Trump donor, has leveraged his role atop the Federal Housing Finance Agency to push investigations, policy proposals, and pressure major home builders. Moves critics say test ethical boundaries. State lawmakers are taking a look at the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, after the turmoil of the federal government shutdown. California State Senator Jesse Arguin, chair of the Human Services Committee, called for the hearing, saying, quote, SNAP benefits are being used as a political football. Panelists described the impacts of the shutdown as well as the future impacts of the Big Beautiful Bill. Kennedy Cuello reports.
State Senator Jesse Arguin called for a Senate Human Services Committee hearing on SNAP, known in California as CalFresh, to discuss the effects of the federal shutdown and recent legislation. The hearing featured a panel on the effects of the government shutdown and another on the effects of House Resolution 1, also known as President Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. H.R. 1 changes the qualifications for CalFresh, which will result in some people losing eligibility for the program. David Swanson Hollinger is the Chief Deputy Director for the California Department of Social Services. He emphasizes the importance of CalFresh to California residents.
It's the largest anti-hunger program in the state. It serves more than 5.5 million low-income individuals each month, which is about 3.3 million households across the state. And each month, $1 billion in federal CalFresh benefits to eligible Californians.
Two of Arguin's constituents from Richmond talked about how important CalFresh is to them. Chris Navarro and his wife are former educators who have retired and now live on a fixed income. They said that when they realized that their Social Security wasn't enough to live comfortably and buy groceries, CalFresh was a lifeline for them. During the shutdown, they had to stretch their CalFresh money, rationing their food and even skipping meals because of fear that the money from October was going to have to last through the holidays. Despite the government shutdown ending, Navarro says the fear remains.
We still remember that when families, seniors need help, the federal government fought to block
CalFresh and staff benefits. Well, remember that. Instead of protecting people, leaders allowed millions to go through unnecessary fear, hunger, and confusion. We always believed the government was supposed to be there to support its people, not make them suffer just to make political points. No one should have to wonder whether their country cares enough to make sure they can eat. We still don't know if our December benefits will come, and living in the constant uncertainty take a real mental and physical toll.
Under H.R. 1, eligibility requirements for CalFresh also change. Certain non-citizens will lose eligibility despite legal status, including refugees and human trafficking victims. Contra Costa County Human Services Director Marla Stewart brought up another change. The new work requirements.
SNAP requires that all able-bodied adults ages 18 to 54 without dependents either work, go to school, participate in work training, or volunteer for 20 hours per week. If they do not, they can only receive SNAP for 3 months every 36 months.
These changes to CalFresh will affect over 97% of recipients. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
In San Francisco, a small group of single mothers just finished a year-long experiment that paid them $2,000 a month for their care work at home. Organizers say the pilot helped women leave sex work, avoid child welfare intervention, and escape violent relationships. KPFA's Annetta Felix has more. Apologies for the technical difficulties. Community activists rallied Wednesday in Brentwood demanding answers and accountability in the death of 72-year-old Yolanda Ramirez, who suffered a fatal brain injury during an encounter with Brentwood police in late September. Ramirez was hospitalized with a brain bleed and died after her family made the difficult decision to remove her from life support on October 3rd. Nearly 2 months later, the Ramirez family says they still have no explanation from Brentwood police about why Yolanda was detained. The only statement they've seen came from a police Facebook post claiming Ramirez had been taken into custody under a, quote, citizen's arrest requested by a family member, a claim her relatives strongly deny. More than 100 people gathered before and after Wednesday night's Brentwood City Council meeting, joining the Ramirez family in demanding transparency, an independent investigation, and justice for Yolanda. The family's attorney, civil rights lawyer Melissa Nold, addressed the crowd ahead of the meeting, criticizing the police department's lack of communication and the ongoing absence of answers about what happened to Ramirez while in their custody.
Tossed her in the car like trash. They dragged her into the car and then they left her there. Witnesses say it was 20, 30, 40 minutes. They didn't go back. They weren't checking on this elder. And they know that she was injured. She was crying out in pain. And when they did finally go back, they opened the door and one of them looked at her. They didn't say anything to her. Very telling that they didn't speak to her at that time or say anything. And then they go back and huddle up and then they all go over and look at her. Within a few minutes, the ambulance was coming. And she never woke up from that point.
According to witnesses, police hit the 72-year-old's head while she was handcuffed, which resulted in her body going limp inside the police car. Yolanda's brother-in-law, Paul Ramirez, said that the statement the police released was, quote, full of lies.
I handcuffed her, forced her on her knees. She's barely able to walk in terms of, like, get around. You don't put a 72-person, force them on their knees, and then the handcuffs? That the officer did not properly lock, so they kept cutting into her wrists. And then to get her into the car and throw in. And then, what was their next priority? They went to go search her van and search her purse. Why? Was there a crime?
Yolanda's son, Richard Ramirez, thanked the community for turning out to support the family at this time. He said it is important to keep the pressure on the Brentwood police to make sure this doesn't happen again.
I hope they realize that this is not going to go away. We're here and we want answers. We want accountability. We want transparency. and we demand justice.
The Brentwood City Council did not take up the issue during its public meeting, but after a closed session, Mayor Susanna Mayer issued a brief statement addressing the growing community concern.
I'd like to read a statement. On behalf of the Brentwood City Council, we want to extend our empathy to the Ramirez family. We also want our community to know that we heard your comments tonight and are committed to transparency and to ensuring that accurate information is shared as we are able to do so. Gather and review information and appreciate the community's patience and understanding as this process continues.
In a post to social media, Brentwood police say they are cooperating with that investigation and will release body-worn camera and dash camera footage in accordance with state law. They declined to comment further due to the active investigation and pending legal claims, but said the department remains committed to, quote, transparency, accountability, and treating all individuals with dignity and respect. The family of a black man killed by a white San Leandro police officer is planning to speak out against Alameda County District Attorney's decision to stop its prosecution against Jason Fletcher, who shot and killed Stephen Taylor as he was experiencing a mental health crisis in 2020. The Anti-Police Terror Project said in a statement it's the latest in a, quote, disturbing pattern of abandoning accountability in cases involving police and sheriff violence. Taylor was reportedly trying to walk out of a Walmart with two items on him when he was confronted by a security guard who called police when Fletcher arrived. Taylor allegedly had a bat and struggled, and a struggle ensued wherein the officer pulled out both his taser and gun and then shot Taylor, killing him. Taylor's grandmother, Addie Kitchen, has fought for 5 years for justice and spoke to KPFA News about the district attorney's decision to not challenge the defense's motion for dismissal in court Friday.
There's no justice in America for people of color. There's no justice in America for people that are murdered by law enforcement if they are of color. Murder is murder. And it just doesn't appear that the courts really care about what law enforcement does to people and to families.
The APTP said in a statement, the office under DA Ursula Jones Dixon has dismissed charges against 8 of 11 officers implicated in the death of Maurice Monk at Santa Rita Jail and quietly dropped a separate case against 2 sheriff's deputies accused of lying about their safety checks on a mentally unstable woman who later died by suicide in custody. They're planning to speak out tomorrow outside the Alameda County Superior Court. Florida students will soon learn a version of McCarthyism and the Cold War that emphasizes anti-communist rhetoric after state education officials approved new social studies standards today. The 29-page History of Communism standards frame McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee as champions of anti-communism and include lessons on communist infiltration of civil rights groups, the use of McCarthyism as an insult, and terms like red baiter and red scare. Critics say the standards downplay the repression and blacklisting that marked the 1950s. The measure follows a 2024 law signed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis requiring new instruction on communism by the 2026 to 2027 school year. The standards cover global communism from Plato's Republic to Mao Zedong and the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests. Historians and educators warn the approach is highly ideological, teaching students what to think rather than how to think. State board members appointed by DeSantis called the curriculum historically grounded and necessary. A shooting at Laney College today wounded the school's athletic director and former longtime football coach, prompting a campus lockdown and heavy police presence. The incident, reported just before noon, marks the second gun-related incident at an Oakland campus in 2 days. The victim, identified by media as John Beam, was rushed to a local hospital. The suspected shooter, described as a man wearing a black hooded sweater, fled the scene and remains at large. The college halted classes for the day and secured the athletics facilities while authorities investigated. The shooting comes a day after another incident at Skyline High School in Oakland, in which a student was shot and 2 juveniles were arrested after two firearms were found on campus. Oakland Mayor Barbara Lee called the two shootings, quote, heartbreaking, and urged urgent action to address gun violence in the city's schools. The investigations are ongoing, and the Oakland Police Department asked anyone with information to come forward. A protester involved in a scuffle outside a conservative advocacy event at the University of California, Berkeley, was arraigned today on felony robbery and battery charges. Jihad DeFerre-Palaz appeared at the Wiley W. Manuel Courthouse in Oakland and is scheduled to return November 24th to enter a plea, the Alameda County District Attorney's Office said. Police allege he took a necklace from a merchandise vendor outside the Turning Point USA event on Monday, leading to a physical altercation that left the vendor with a visible facial injury. Berkeley police initially arrested both men for fighting in public, but later booked DeFerre-Palaz on robbery and battery charges. Multiple arrests were made at the final stop of Turning Point USA's college speaking tour, whose co-founder, Charlie Kirk, was fatally shot at a Utah college in September. The U.S. Department of Justice announced a federal investigation with Assistant Attorney General Hammett Dillon visiting the Bay Area today. UC Berkeley said it does not condone violence and is cooperating with authorities, while activist groups criticize the federal probe as politically motivated. The United Nations unveiled its first refugee climate fund to help replenish lands inhabited by refugees. This comes days after a new UN report this week warned refugee camps are set to be uninhabitable by 2050 as extreme weather worsens in regions most impacted by war, conflict, and the climate crisis. Stéphane Dujarric is a UN spokesperson.
The Refugee Environmental Protection Fund, the world's first large-scale refugee-driven carbon finance initiative. The fund will support reforestation, cleaner cooking, and green jobs that link environmental recovery with sustainable livelihoods and protection outcomes. The fund's first projects, launching in Uganda and Rwanda, mark the first step towards the initiative's 10-year goal of restoring more than 100,000 hectares of land and expanding clean energy access to 1 million people.
A coalition of food, environmental, and animal welfare groups is appealing a federal court decision that upheld an EPA rule exempting large-scale factory farms from publicly disclosing hazardous air emissions. The 2019 rule, issued under the Trump administration, exempts ammonia and hydrogen sulfide emissions from reporting. The group says the exemption leaves nearby communities unaware of potentially harmful pollution, which can cause respiratory problems, headaches, nausea, and in extreme cases, brain damage or death. Simone Perez reports.
Ryan Mahar with the Center for Biological Diversity says those air pollutants kill thousands of people a year, and the public needs to know.
It's really a transparency concern when it comes to controlling pollution from factory farms. Requiring reporting when there's an emergency, when public health is at risk, is really the bare minimum.
Industry groups, including the Cattlemen's Association, argue the reporting rules are burdensome and would raise the cost of food. They say they're following the law as written. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Meanwhile, authorities in Oklahoma say a leaking tanker truck spewed hazardous ammonia in a hotel parking lot overnight, forcing hundreds of residents to evacuate and hospitalizing several dozen people. The anhydrous ammonia leak happened late yesterday in Weatherford. City officials said today that at least four people were in critical condition. Schools closed and several nursing homes evacuated. A shelter-in-place order was lifted this morning. The city's police chief said the leak happened after the truck driver had parked behind a Holiday Inn Express for the night. Officials said the leak might be due to a mechanical failure. Bay Area weather tonight, mostly cloudy with a high chance of rain, lows in the mid-50s, mostly cloudy tomorrow morning before clearing a little to partly cloudy, a chance of rain, highs in the mid-60s. In the Central Valley, showers and a possible thunderstorm tonight, lows in the high 50s. That will continue through tomorrow morning with highs in the low 60s. In Los Angeles, there will be showers tonight with lows in the high 50s. Tomorrow, more showers with highs in the low 60s. That's it for the news. I'm Scott Baba. Rod Akil is at the controls. Good evening.
K-P-F-K. KPFK is hosting a meet and greet for listeners and supporters from Ventura, Oxnard, Carpinteria, and Santa Barbara on Saturday, November 15th from 11 till 4 p.m. at the First Congregational Church located in Santa Barbara. The entrance is on the corner of State Street and West Padre Street. This event includes a potluck for which all are invited to participate as we want to break bread together with our listeners. We look forward to meeting each and every one of you in Santa Barbara. Further information can be found at kpfk.org. Breaking bread with my brother.